Hey, Rolando.
What's up?
This is a unique episode we're about to do.
Is it?
Of all the times we have watched remakes, reboots, and revivals, I'm not really sure if what we're tackling today is qualified for any of those.
I would argue the only reason I think it's a revival is only because by name.
Mm-hmm.
Though technically speaking, it is.
Technically it's not, but it's worth talking about.
It's definitely worth talking about because I think this is pushing us more towards a realm of adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
That I think when we're doing a show like this, you can't separate. I mean, we could separate it. We've done a good job of separating for a year and a half. However,
yes.
It's going to come to a point where like adaptation itself will become something that we will have to like start considering.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of proving a point as to why we should start considering it.
Definitely. So this might open up some new doors for us.
Mm.
The clock is ticking. It's a new year. It's going to be a new decade. And what better way to celebrate it than to cover Watchmen?
The Watchmen.
So I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality. So today we have a very, very special guest with us today. Eddie Z. Say hi.
Hey guys, how are you?
Eddie Z is always our special guest, but we also have a very, very special guest.
Yes, today we have Lincoln Farquharson, co-founder of Far Corner Studios. And what is Far Corner Studios for our audience who don't know?
We're an independent comic book publishing company.
Uh-huh.
Based out of Newark, New Jersey.
So tell me a little bit about what kind of comics do you guys publish?
Well, superhero type, mm-hmm. The traditional spandexed type mm-hmm. version, but it's a little different. I mean, my perspective is putting it in real life. If you and I were gaining super abilities, would we automatically be in skin tights? No, we would be in regular clothes, doing mm-hmm. regular things, maybe being exploitive or maybe being courageous or just maybe being scared.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't fall into the typical superhero genre where you're going out, as soon as you open up the book, people are just fighting crime.
Mm-hmm.
It's really going through their real life personal issues. And sometimes that falls into helping someone else. Sometimes it doesn't.
Interesting. Mm. And an excellent segue to today's topic.
Yes.
Because Alan Moore wrote Watchmen. I don't actually know the year. It was the 80s.
1986.
So yeah. Watchmen was written in 1986. And Alan Moore's, his whole point of the Watchmen is like trying to bring in superheroes. Like, what if superheroes were in the real world? Like, how does that affect the geopolitical sphere of the world? And it gives us the birth of one of comic books, I guess, most powerful beings, Dr. Manhattan. And I think it also created Rorschach, who I think is an interesting study in almost human psyche. Like, what happens when an abused man gets puts on a mask?
Mm.
And, you know, what does that do? You know, it really questions, like, what is a hero? You know, are vigilantes heroes and stuff? And it's a, you know, we're talking a little bit about the comic book because the comic book is just as important as the adaptation that we'll be talking about with Zack Snyder's film.
Yes.
And HBO's new version by Damon Lindelof.
Yes, because in this episode, we're not going to compare so much characters in the way they did it, but we're actually going to compare themes because the theme mm-hmm. of the book translated into the film and now the 2019 HBO series is really pivotal to understanding what we're trying to get from mm-hmm. all of it.
Yeah, and can I just say that was the idea of hero and villain. A lot of times we jump on this idea of, you know, people ask me, for example, who's the hero, who's the villain? But it's not as cookie cutter as that. I mean, you have the Supermans and, you know, you have your Batmans. You have all these people who are clearly good and clearly bad. But in my book, and as well as The Watchmen, the question is, are they really good or are they really bad? It's really about the actions that people take. Right.
Yeah.
And what the circumstances that led them to that moment. You know, if I kill someone, I'm bad. But if I kill someone in self-defense, then I'm not bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the circumstance.
Yeah.
It's all about what their their backstory is. And sometimes through comic books, we can explore backstories to really get understanding and feel sympathy or just hate the person or really love the person. Right. But in real life, you don't always get that. And so it's interesting how in comic books, how an artist or a writer can play those themes out.
Let's go back to 1986 when this comic book was released. It was released in parts up until 1987, and I think they released a whole collector's edition in full in 1987. And, you know, this is the Reagan era. The USSR was still very much a thing. It didn't become dissolved until 1991. So our relationship with Russia was complicated, to say the least. And it was a really good, the 80s were scary, guys.
To say the least. We're like in the Cold War.
But the 80s were scary. Like 80s, you know, music and movies, they're so like fun and lighthearted, you know, like the 80s didn't believe in like bad endings, happy endings all around. Right. But like the 80s itself was scary.
Yeah.
I mean, AIDS and everything that was just going on and the presidency just like ignoring it.
Uh-huh.
A really, really big gap between like those who were doing well and those who were not doing well financially really started in the 80s, right? So there's just like kind of a moral panic happening, I feel, when I look back on the 80s. And so this book was written, and Alan Moore, who is also the author of a very famous Batman graphic novel, The Killing Joke.
The Killing Joke.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, V for Vendetta.
V for Vendetta.
I like to call him the Stanley Kubrick of graphic novels. Mm. He decided that he was going to kind of take comic books and everything that we kind of knew about in our perception of superheroes and turn it a bit on its head. Mm-hmm. So Watchmen takes place in the year of 1985 in an alternate version of America because of the fact that superheroes came to life in the early 40s.
Specifically, Dr. Manhattan came to life.
Specifically. So people pretty much, when I say superheroes, people decided to put on masks,
yeah,
and outfits. They were ordinary people who did this.
Uh-huh.
There's only one person in the world who has a superpower, and that was a man named John Osterman who went into a radioact. What happened exactly?
So he went into, he left his watch in a chamber where they're going to run experiments, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a Manhattan Project.
Yes.
And he got locked in there. They couldn't unlock him. So he kind of was just like fated to die. And then days later, I think 3 days later, right? It was almost supposed to be like the resurrection of Christ.
Yeah.
3 days later, he comes back as his blue being, Dr. Manhattan. And Dr. Manhattan has these cool powers where he can like perceive time. Like he doesn't see time like we do, where we're linear. Mm-hmm. He sees time at all times, right? So
yes,
when you're talking with him, he might be talking to you now, but like his mind is also like 10 years later or
yeah,
10
yeah,
years in the past. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And,
but keep in mind, his limitation is only he can only see his time.
Right, right.
Yes. He's not a fortune teller.
Yeah, he's not omniscient. He can only right, see what he sees.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he can teleport. He can create. He has like godlike powers.
Yes.
Matter manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 40s and the early times of the 20th century, there were people who donned capes, heroes like Hooded Justice, Silk Spectre, one, the comedian.
The Owlman one.
Who's the one that Hooded Justice had an affair with?
Hooded Justice, I think, is from the TV show. I don't know if he was in the actual.
No, he was.
He was in the Minutemen.
Yeah, they all were real.
Ah, okay. So
Captain Metropolis.
Yes, Captain Metropolis.
Then in this world.
I thought Hooded Justice came before.
He was one of the first ones.
He was supposed to be the first one that inspired.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's also the one that in the Watchmen universe, his identity never really comes out.
Right.
Until the show.
Spoiler.
So, because of the fact that Dr. Manhattan in particular exists, a lot of events that happened in our universe did not happen in the Watchmen universe. Watergate was never exposed.
Right.
We won the Vietnam War, and they surpassed the law that presidents can pretty much have as many terms as they like. So right, Nixon is president up until the 80s, mm-hmm, and people love Nixon. They have like faith in him. So
weird times, man.
But in 1977, an act passed called the Keen Act that completely banned the use of people becoming mass vigilantes.
Right.
So if you decided to, you would be a criminal and you could be persecuted by the law. Mm-hmm. So the Minutemen were out loud, and all the people that once did this were no longer to. So this is sets place 8 years after that law passed, and we're picking up with people who used to.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who continues on his private time to become a mass vigilante is a character named Rorschach. And he does so because one of his old pals, the comedian, has been murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And he visits each one to try and gain information. A lot of this is from his point of view. And the main people are Ozymandias,
who is Adrian Veidt. He mm-hmm. is... Ozymandias is his hero name, but like he's supposed to be the smartest man in the world.
Self-proclaimed smartest man in the world. Very rich, all this stuff.
And he's a good fighter.
Night Owl 2 by who is his real name is Daniel Dreiberg.
I think that's how you say it.
Yeah. Edward Blake was the comedian who was part of the original Minutemen, so he's one of the oldest.
Yeah.
Dr. Manhattan is a part of this, and his girlfriend, Silk Spectre, too.
Who is technically his second girlfriend.
Who is sick.
His first girlfriend.
Sally.
He abandoned when she started getting old.
Yeah. Fucked up.
Wife, you're right. They were married. Yes.
So the thing about this book is that I, in my opinion at least, and I'm pretty sure that we can all agree, is that Alan Moore based a lot of these characters on superheroes that we've all grown up with. You could say that Dr. Manhattan is kind of like his version of Superman.
I would agree.
You could say Rorschach is his version of Batman.
That's interesting. I actually thought Owlman was more Batman-like.
I would say Rorschach just because he's like really an ordinary guy who like does everything like in his own like terms.
Yeah. The only reason I actually think more so Owlman is literally because of the inventions. Owlman is known for his like gizmos and gadgets, and that's what we know Batman more so.
True. I'm not trying to like quote Alan Moore here that it is this way, but I guess for me I kind of like to look at him as the anti-Batman because of how demented he is.
Mm-hmm.
So to me Watchmen is about people who aren't that great, who do quote-unquote good things in the name of goodness and stuff, and how the people that we look up to are not as they seem.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like when you really see how superheroes, quote unquote superheroes, are in their real day-to-day lives? They commit rape. They like go ahead and they
allegedly commit rape.
They, you know, Rorschach breaks people's fingers just to get information that he doesn't even need to get. You know, like really down to the core of it, these people that we look up to, Dr. Manhattan doesn't at the end of the day give a shit about people, like the Superman that we all love.
So that's, I'm sorry to cut you off, but that's exactly what I was thinking about, how it's actually the opposite of the people you're actually saying. So
yeah,
it's not Superman is like the opposite of Superman, keeping the same somewhat similar power, but is not, it's the opposite of him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so even for Rorschach is really the opposite. I thought of like the Joker, where the Joker has the same exact personality, but just does it for an evil purpose, where Rorschach does it for a good purpose. But they have the same method and mode of operation. They're both lunatics in the sense.
Yeah,
they are
both in the same asylums. And they're both highly skilled in what they do. But the Joker doesn't do it for good purposes. Rorschach does.
Yeah.
Same thing for Owlman and Batman. Batman, they both had the same skills when it comes down to knowledge and inventions and all that. However, the Owlman is a little bit more nicer and calmer. Personality-wise, he's the opposite of Batman.
And
he's
sexually impotent. That's important for the Owlman. No, it's
right,
true.
Right.
Yeah,
so like, that's part of the reason.
And he's shyer, you know what I mean? But the skill set of Batman that we know Batman to be, like what you're saying, as far as inventions and knowledge and skill
and raw sexual magnetism,
right? it's him, right?
Yeah.
I guess the reason why I would disagree though about Rorschach is because I don't think he's a good character. I don't think he does good things. I think he's a selfish character who does selfish things, which a lot of people, which I also think Alan Moore really wanted to portray these people as self-absorbed, self-concerned.
I don't disagree with you. However, by the end of the comic book, Rorschach is the only one who's kind of willing to stand up for truth.
True. Well, right. Is truth a good thing? According to Watchmen. Well, that's also something that I think Watchmen does a really good job at, is what is good and what is bad. It kind of like draws a line, because there's a big thing that happens in this book. Like essentially it's a murder mystery that you're trying to solve towards the very end.
Mystery turns conspiracy.
Right.
And so basically, to summarize the rest of the book series, what Rorschach ends up discovering is that these mass vigilantes that are getting murdered, the reason they're getting murdered is because something is about to go down. And something goes down in New York City. A giant squid monster is unleashed in New York City. And suddenly, this whole world, we're like at the brink of war, nuclear apocalypse. As a result, we all have to come together and kind of decide, it's just like, as a human species, it's like, all right, we have a bigger threat that is bigger than, you know, our differences.
Yes.
And as a result, it kind of brings about a version of world peace. This was all, as Rorschach will discover, this is all a conspiracy by Adrian Veidt, who was Ozymandias, who he himself believes to be a savior, and that he is the only hope that humanity has. He's the one who unleashed this interdimensional monster that he created to, in order to create world peace. The other vigilantes, when they also uncover this conspiracy, what they do is they decide to stay silent for what they see as the good of humanity.
Yes.
Despite the fact that Rorschach believes truth is what
better
is
for the good of
the good of humanity.
Yeah.
And
so
that's ultimately, and the comic ends with like Rorschach leaving his journals for the New Frontiersmen, which was like the newspaper, and you know, ends the last scene, the last, you know, what do you, panel is cool because basically, as readers, we get to decide what happens next. Do they unleash a story and kind of reveal the truth?
Yeah.
Or do they not?
Yeah. And it that's why it's also like, okay, well, wow. Like, what would you do in that situation? Like, you really put yourself in that shoe and it's like, oh my gosh, what is good and what is bad? And I think Alan Moore also does a really good job. I'm going to focus on Rorschach as to like portraying superheroes or people who don themselves as vigilantes as really flawed, not admirable characters, you know, because like this is meant for a generation of people who read graphic novels and comic books and looked up to these people. And he's like, I'm going to show you Rorschach. And here's a quote that he said, actually, that I found about him saying about Rorschach. Quote, I wanted to make Rorschach as like, this is what Batman would be in the real world. But I have forgotten that that actually, to a lot of comic book fans, smelling, not having a girlfriend, these are actually kind of heroic qualities. So Rorschach became the most popular character in Watchmen. I made him to be a bad example, but I have people come up to me in the street saying, I'm Rorschach, this is my story. And I'm thinking, great, could you just keep away from me and never come near to me as long as I live?
Sounds like
so
Alan
that's
Moore.
Interesting. Yeah, he sounds like an asshole, but it's really interesting because I think he wrote Rorschach to be an asshole. Rorschach, you know, does not believe that he treats Laurie like she's a second class citizen because she's a woman, doesn't like care about the fact that she
he has very fucked up issues with women in general,
fucked up issues with women,
with his mother.
Yes. You know, he's crazy, like when he's not doing this, he's just on the street, you know, talking about the end of the world and just like being a crazy person. Really like treats people badly just for information that is important to him, which is why I also would compare him to Batman. So he's not good at what he does, but he thinks he is,
right?
But at the end of the day, too, I agree with you. Dr. Manhattan is a better example of what a man with superhuman powers would be. Not Superman. Superman wouldn't stick around and save the world. He'd peace out and go to Mars.
He does. Well, he was
exiled because you guys figured out. Well, because he was framed and stuff. To me, the most realistic character that I think that is the best example to is also the comedian.
Ooh, interesting choice. Okay, go on.
You know, he doesn't believe in what he does, but he can't help but do it, right? So it's kind of like this almost weird version of how people kind of like cynicism and skepticism can like ruin your life, but it's also the only way you know how to survive. Because he was part of the original Minutemen, and then he just works for the FBI afterwards. Right. And like, but then he like finds out all this stuff, and it just like, it ends up destroying him. And like, he doesn't even know how to continue living, but he has to until he's murdered.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of like, when you look at the world for what it is and you just like, you can't believe it. And like, what is it all for? And you're just like completely robbed of, and this is really bleak. Okay. I know this is like
the Watchmen
terribly bleak.
Is a pretty bleak property.
Yeah.
You know, when I think of, you know, I do a lot of psychoanalysis of everything. I mean, that's kind of what my profession on the side also was working with young people and just people and trying to counsel them and move them forward. And so when I think of him, I always look at how would we all be, as easy for us to be on the outside. And that's why I like writing like this, you know, because it's easy for us to pass all these judgments on a character like the comedian. But when I don't see is what I see is something different. I see a person who's went through a series of trauma, right? And this is their way of dealing with it to the best of their ability. What we see is this crazy person who's just, you know, reacting to these things, and why is he killing everybody, you know, and, you know, why is he acting this way? But there's a story to that person that we just don't know. And again, we're trying to put them into a box saying, why are you doing bad things, right? You must be a bad guy. Why are you doing good things? You must be a good guy. and not realizing what is the reason that shaped them into who they are, which makes for great character development, right? And I don't know how deep the comic books have been into developing each individual character's backstory or stories in general. But
it's, or the Watchmen?
Yeah, each individual character, I mean.
So yeah, there's been a series of comics that kind of like since talk about their origins.
Yeah. So I would imagine, you know, once you understand their story, which goes back to our original part about being authentic to character writing, once you know their original story, you're like, oh, they're really not a good or a bad person. Mm-hmm. They're just a person that's been dealing with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
I think it's a good thing that we're actually talking a lot about the comic book, mm-hmm. because there's actually more time that we usually devote to comic books. But the reason, actually, I would argue it's important to talk about the comic book is because our main topic, which is Zack Snyder's Watchmen from 2009, mm-hmm. is one of the few examples we've seen of a very, very paper-to-screen adaptation for a comic book. And that can be both seen as a criticism mm-hmm. or a compliment. Who we've all seen Watchmen. 2009.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Initial thoughts, everyone.
So, now Robin. I remember when it came out.
2009.
2009. This was like the beginning of the superhero craze. Yeah. Weird, Iron Man came out in 2008.
Yeah.
That sounds, Hulk did too.
Batman
Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Well, 2008 was a really prominent year for the superhero thing. So I think that was the year that it was like, it's here to stay.
We're definitely, yeah, for sure. I will agree with you there.
So this was the, this was March 29th, 2009. I don't like this film. What about you?
I thought the film was good. It was different. I can see why people didn't like it. It's not the typical superhero genre type of movie. Mm-hmm. It was rather long for a movie in the beginning. Batman Begins was 3 hours, I think, two.
It was not. It was like 2 hours and change.
Felt like it.
That's how I felt
after 2 hours. It feels like three.
Right. So, but I thought that, again, I'm looking for, as a writer, I look at different things. So mm-hmm. for me, I thought that it was a great way to show real people, mm-hmm. if they had the ability to do what they're doing, mm-hmm. how would they really be? Mm-hmm. And I thought that's what I liked about it. You know, it was just different. It was a different spin to the whole superhero view. And, it was all right. I liked it.
It was all right. It's okay.
I mean, it wasn't like, Avengers. Like, oh my God, going to see it.
I'm not going to
But I didn't dislike it.
I generally think, and I'm speaking in broad strokes here, but I think that's generally the feeling that actually even most comic book fans felt about this movie. But Eddie Z, what were your thoughts?
I enjoyed it. I didn't see it in the movie theaters. I saw it as a DVD.
Okay.
And I saw the director's cut mm-hmm. too. I enjoyed it. It was different for me.
Yeah. So I think for me, my initial reaction when I saw the movie was just like, I saw it in theaters. I actually saw it opening weekend.
Yeah.
I remember leaving the movie kind of liking it. It had a great soundtrack. It was a visual feast. The movie had great aesthetics, and I will give, we've talked a little bit about Zack Snyder films before where mm-hmm. like he knows how to kind of paint, he knows how to paint a frame.
Yeah.
That does not make him a good filmmaker.
No, it doesn't.
I think he can give you visuals galore, but again, that does not mean that it is a good film. I mm-hmm. think his story here kind of lacks a little bit of the depth that the comic book had to a fault. That's not to criticize a movie to say that it's not like a bad movie. I think at the end of the day, like this movie is a watchable movie. I think the reason it is so divisive, though, it is because, again, we focus a lot on Rorschach, and Rorschach himself is just not such a good character, right? He just isn't. He's not a good protagonist, and, everything is a moral quandary in this film, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Like, what is Adrian Veidt in the right to, in this case, in the movie, the big difference is that he frames Dr. Manhattan instead of releasing a squid monster, but...
Mm-hmm.
Is Adrian Veidt right, in unleashing this plan in order to unite the world. And once again, we see Rorschach is a stern no. Dr. Manhattan kills him just like we do in the comics and stuff. But it just ends up feeling cold in his filmmaking technique. Because it's just like...
I don't know. I mean, I have to push back a little bit. And I guess we're looking at two different... Like, I'm looking at it from a writer's perspective. Mm-hmm. Looking at it from a videographer's perspective. And right. So I'm not... I didn't even think about framing and all that. I was really looking at character development, right?
Well, and story. Actually, I would argue that when you look at a film, the most important thing you have to look at is the framing. Because you're not reading something, you're watching something.
So, and framing is just like how you place the camera and like what you see on the screen. Mm-hmm. I'm not even just talking about that. I just mean overall, his... Zack Snyder is very much a visual aesthetics kind of filmmaker. Yes. Where a lot of his film really, really is like anchored on the aesthetics choices that he makes in this film. A lot of it, for example, like Zack Snyder is just really known for his overuse of slow-mo. Where I think the film, which was a heavy action film, which was 300, right, mm-hmm. was kind of where he started doing that, like, adapting, like, frame by frame what a movie version of, like, a comic book would be. That worked well in that one because that's, like, a war movie, mm-hmm. and it's a very, very isolated story. Here, The Watchmen is this grand, sprawling story that it doesn't just, it's set in 1985. However, a lot of the story doesn't just take place in 1985 because we have to see some of these characters' backstories and kind of seeing like how did we get from the 1940s where the Minutemen were to now, and how did we get into this mess as a society. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of flashbacks. There's a lot of, I think, and I'm not criticizing the movie because I think he did do a good job of kind of adapting this novel. I think my critique is more like it just feels cold.
Well, so I would agree with you, but in a different way. I think that Zack Snyder is a fanboy, but I think that this was put in the hands of someone who's probably read this graphic novel and, in my opinion, got something completely different out of it than I did. I'm not going to say that he's wrong, but I think he kind of, I feel like Zack Snyder misunderstood Watchmen. When the film, the first 10 minutes, I already am like, oh my God, this guy does not understand what he's adapting here. Mm-hmm. When the comedian gets killed and we watch this whole scene, we see someone who has superhuman strength. The comedian does not have superhuman strength. He's an average, everyday man. He's an old man. Why are we watching such an action fight sequence?
Actually, that's a very good point. Despite the fact that the action was in the comics, it wasn't nowhere near as violent.
It was nowhere near. And Alan Moore wanted to... I think one of the biggest things that we're supposed to get out of Watchmen is that these are ordinary people who just don masks. They don't have these superhuman strengths. Uh-huh. They're not like above... like, so the action is not what's important. It's the fact that this old man was murdered. So he's focusing on the wrong things, first of all. And then we spend a lot of time talking about Rorschach. He makes Rorschach look cool.
Oh, by the way, you keep saying Rorschach.
Or Rorschach or whatever his name
Rorschach.
Is. Rorschach. Like the Rorschach he makes, test. Thank you. No, I know what it is. I'm just saying it wrong. He makes him look cool. He gives him this cool voice, Rorschach's journal, and all this stuff.
And he's played by a cool... the actor did a very good and he job did, of portraying this character. That
he made him look cool, though.
I don't but know. That's, but that's also the business of filmmaking, too. I mean, you have to make sure...
No, I think that's a general statement.
No, but like even Alan Moore kind of had that problem because you said like people came up to him saying, just like, oh, I love Rorschach. I'm Rorschach.
Well, yeah, so the person that came up to him was Zack Snyder. And then he went and adapted this movie.
and I deal with these even in, you know, comic book writing, right? People want to see a character and they relate to something they know. Mm-hmm. So they'll say, oh, that's like, you know, something from Dragon Ball Z or something they already know. So they want to connect it to something. Where this was the first time, I believe, this was the first time we had a major film like this that showed heroes that weren't heroes or villains that weren't villains. And people are still trying to figure out who is the protagonist here, who's the antagonist here, and they couldn't figure that out. Like, who was actually leading the team? Was it the Owlman or Rorschach? Right. But so, what was Rorschach's role? Was he like the comedic person? Was he like the, you know, the person who kept the movie going? And then why should we follow him? Like, who should we pay more attention to? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, you know, we when we watch a movie, we're looking for certain elements to exist. Mm-hmm. And talking about superhero movies, we're looking for certain elements to exist. And this one didn't really give you, from the superhero perspective, the definitive element. But I think to your point about why it didn't follow the book the mm-hmm. way it should have been, you know, would it have been a great fight scene Or would it have been a great intro when the guy came into the apartment just to kill an old man? Or would it have been better to have a legitimate fight scene, right? And so for a person who's never been, but keep in mind, for a person who's never seen the book or seen a comic book, that's what we want to see.
But you, you can have a legitimate fight scene and not give him superhero strength. And I guess for me, what was wrong about the movie, and to what Rolando was saying, is that it felt cold. The performances weren't wrong. The performances were great. It looked great. Yeah. It looked like it was the comic book brought to life. Yeah, it was pretty literal.
It had great soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like the music. You're working the 80s and 60s. So, like, you have so much good music to choose from, and they really capitalized on it.
And they did it. Yeah. So everything there was right. It looks right.
Oh.
You know? But what was wrong was the tone. What was wrong was that Zack Snyder didn't know the tone to take, in my opinion. What was wrong is that you have this being adapted in the hands of somebody who thought it was something that it wasn't. He thought it was a cool thing that needed cool action, legitimate action fight sequence and stuff, when it doesn't need that. We talking about the graphic novel, we said the word bleak. The film does not feel that way. The direction feels cold.
I would actually disagree. I actually do think the reason the film does feel bleak, it does at times. But the only reason it feels bleak, though, I would say is because of the color grading. Yeah. It's because, again, it's building that atmosphere.
Yeah.
It was a visual representation of bleak. Yeah. You don't get that as much from the actual story, though. Yeah.
No, and I think, you know, there's this film essayist, Lindsay Ellis. She has this quote that I think really sums up how I feel about Watchmen, which is framing and aesthetic supersede the rest of the text always. And I think that, yeah, when I look at this film and I see the fact that in the first 10 minutes, I'm getting a fight sequence that belongs more in 300 than it does in the world of 1985's alternate history of America's Watchmen, I'm like, the aesthetics of this film do not line up with what I'm being told. And that is more important than what I'm being told, what I'm seeing. I'm seeing superhuman strength, but I'm supposed to be told that this is an average man. Because I see superhuman strength, I don't believe it.
I think another problem the film may have had, and this is more so a problem from the direct adaptation to film,
yeah,
which are trying to be like literal, like giving us these, like how it looks in the comics or how it looks in the movie. I think one of the other problems we have there is that Alan Moore, and Eddie, you pointed this out, like he wrote this book to be specifically a comic book, because with comics you have this ability to kind of look at time non-linearly in a way that you really can't do that with filmmaking.
Yes.
Eddie, what has Alan Moore said in the past about like his, because you're the one who got me this.
Yeah.
No, I mean, in the sense of like not being happy of having his work turn into a movie. He said that this is, he wrote this story for this medium and for this medium only. Comic books are not still movies. They're their own medium, and they should be respected and treated in that way. And he wanted his work respected and treated in that way.
Yeah.
That's why his name is not on the film, because he specifically said, if I don't own this work, my name is not on it.
And I will say, as a comic writer, I mean, that is, there are things you can do. And I mean, even as a writer, period, there's things you're going to be able to write about that you, it just does not translate well in film. And film is a, they want a particular format that's going to sell. You're talking about $200 million in a movie to make a movie and market it. They need to know that, you know, I remember, for example, we wrote a Wonder Woman script.
Okay. Oh.
I wrote a Wonder Woman script, me and my co-founder of Far Corner Studios. This is how we, before we founded the comic book company, we used to write scripts.
Was it a movie script or was it?
It was a movie script.
Oh, a movie script.
It was the, it was before Wonder Woman. It was like back when Spider-Man 3 came out. It was we should have.
So this is early in the comic book.
Yeah. So this is, we were going to write a Wonder Woman script. I have it still, if you ever want to read it, by the way.
Do you want to share with our audience? Because we can put a show link.
I guess I could now that Wonder Woman is out. I mean,
oh my God, you guys, we're going to see a spec script for Wonder Woman by Lincoln.
Very cool.
Exciting.
So we had done a Wonder Woman script. When we pitched it to the lawyers in Hollywood, their response was, this is good for those who know Wonder Woman. This is not good for Hollywood. Because the vast majority of people who we make movies for are people who are not fans. And so they needed a Wonder Woman that could connect to people who have no idea what Wonder Woman is. Now, from my view, the script still looked good for that, right? Whether you knew Wonder Woman or not, it was still a great story. But their formula for writing movies in Hollywood is not the same as what we would think if you're a writer, just a normal writer. And so that's kind of what Alan Moore is saying. That's kind of what why the director did what he did, because there's certain things that the audience, that they know that an audience that comes to see a movie is looking to see, that is going to generate the revenue to make a profit from this movie. And it doesn't sound, I don't know how to explain it beyond that, because that's just how they broke it down to us. And I just have to say, okay, that's just how it is.
It is, you're right. And actually, you're kind of turning my opinion right now that I have on this movie, because you're right, because when I think of Watchmen, the truth is, like, more people in America actually have probably seen the movie than have read the book. Although that might be argumentative only because, like, it didn't perform that well in the box office.
Yeah, it did not.
Like, I think it had, what, $120 million budget?
It had $130 to $138 million budget, and it only raked in $185 million.
Yeah, that's, like, scraping by. So, yeah, but I would say more people know the... Yeah. Well, yeah, once we get to the new one.
Yeah, when we get to the new one.
Because I had to run to the bathroom. But no, but yeah, so I think more people actually know the movie, but I think the movie did do a good job of kind of setting up this world. And even though the movie is not directly related to the TV show, mm-hmm. because America has that understanding of what this movie was and they have something to kind of look back to, it kind of helps us introduce this world again in 2019 to 2019. In a very fascinating HBO TV show. After this message.
'Tis the season to be jolly and joyous and giving, guys. It's the holiday season. And please show your support this holiday season by supporting our lovely podcast.
Yeah, you could support us by donating today to our GoFundMe page. Mm-hmm. And you can find the links on our show notes. You'll find links on our Facebook pages. You could also find links on our Instagram. The link will be in the bio.
Mm-hmm. We are winter babies too, so this will be a limited time offer from my birthday of December 6th.
Through January 17th, my birthday.
Yes, yeah, so our birthdays, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Epiphany...
Festivus, you know, whatever you celebrate.
Yes. If you've enjoyed our podcast and you're a listener and you want to help us out with getting maybe some better equipment, just to give you guys overall better quality episodes, we would really appreciate it this wonderful holiday season. All right, guys, now back to the show.
It's 2019, HBO surprised us all when they had announced that they're going to do a Watchmen TV show. For many reasons, mostly it's just like, wow, HBO's like kind of sinking down to like the comic book level. I felt that's my initial reaction to
sinking. Wow.
Oh, it's because keep in mind, like when you think of HBO, it's not television, it's fucking HBO.
It's HBO.
Yeah. So there's like kind of like a high level.
But they did Game of Thrones, which is a book.
But books are different, I think, than comic books. I feel like comic books, even like to the common reader, is a kind of lowbrow. Despite the fact that I agree, Watchmen is a highbrow. That's why when I read it in high school, I was way too mature for it. However, Game of Thrones is wrapping up. They kind of need some new properties to kind of fill in that void, yeah. Because they know they're going to be in a world of hurt.
Yeah, they have Netflix to compete with, Amazon, so they need to up their game.
Right, so as a result... HBO surprises all with Watchmen, starring mm-hmm. Regina King as Angela Abar. Yeah. And the Watchmen TV series, we're going to give you guys a lot of spoilers because I think we all finished it.
Yes.
Although, full disclosure, I'm like 20 minutes out of the last minute of the last episode.
You don't know.
I'm well aware. I don't know what's happening to the last
episode. Oh, my. That's the most important part.
Shit.
There's so many important parts of this show. So.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
But... it's a fascinating show.
It is
a interesting show that I think is now this where Zack Snyder kind of created a scene by scene replica of The Watchmen. This version by Damon Lindelof.
Yes.
He really takes The Watchmen and says just like, all right, let's take all this that they've built and we're going to put it in 2019 and see like what effects that has now.
Yeah, so pretty much it exists within this alternative universe of America. If you don't know Damon Lindelof, he was the co-creator and showrunner of Lost. Mm-hmm. And he also worked on this film. He co-wrote the science fiction films Cowboys and Aliens, Prometheus, Star Trek Into Darkness. He did Tomorrowland, and he also co-created The Leftovers. So this guy has quite the resume already.
He does.
And so
how was Cowboys and Aliens?
It was all right.
I did not go see that one.
It was like, you remember it somewhat. So.
Yeah, because of the title. Cowboys vs. Aliens.
Yeah. So he had the really ambitious idea of taking a property and setting it 30 years later. So Watchmen is not a remake of the comic book. It's not, it doesn't reboot anything. There's brand new characters, and it just says, let's take this alternative universe of America and update it for 2019.
It revives the Watchmen.
Yes. Is what I keep, mm-hmm. Because that's how we're talking about it. Right. Yeah.
But it definitely did revive Watchmen, and it kind of gave the Watchmen something that it desperately needed, which is identity politics.
Yes.
Because it's crazy that you can do a story about the 60s and like the 80s and stuff, and like there's absolutely no mention of race, because race is so integrated with American history. It just is.
It is.
All right. And they kind of not whitewashing, they just don't, there's no mention of it.
No, there's absolutely there really
no
isn't.
Representation.
And I don't remember seeing any black people.
There's none. There are no none. People of color in The Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
In Zack Snyder's Watchmen. Mm-hmm. But I, if I remember correctly, there weren't really any either in the comic book.
So in this Watchmen, we take place. It takes place in an unlikely place, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. We learn, and this happens to be true, Tulsa was also known as Black Wall Street because mm-hmm. black people were very prominent and they were becoming wealthy in this city. As a result, though, they're white people, of course, is just like, no, 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 we can't have this happen. And there's a massacre that occurs.
Yeah.
And black business owners and black people are just murdered, slaughtered. And this is actually based on true events. Like yes. this is actual 1921 real American history.
Tulsa yes. race massacre. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Did you know about that before this show?
No.
Isn't that a travesty? Yeah.
Yes. But keep in mind, I blame the American school system.
Of course.
For this, yeah. Right? Because I didn't know about this. I didn't know that something like this existed. Mm-hmm. Which is, we're going to talk about this, right? Where history and TV show, because we talked about this with Lady the Tramp.
Yeah.
And this conversation is going to come back, and I think this is a good example of this. But anyway, but yeah, so show opens there. 50 years later?
34 years later.
34 years later? What happened?
From 1985.
Oh, that's the White Knight. No.
Oh, wait, what are you talking about?
Well, the show takes place, I don't know. The show does take place in 2019.
Yes.
We're following Angela Abar, who is she's not a mass vigilante. She's actually a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened was there was this thing called the White Knight where cops were killed. Any cop who has an identity, why they were killed, they're a little bit later, but it is race related.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, So Angela Abar is a survivor from the White Knight.
Yes.
She will then, what's it called? So what happens is Joe Keen, who was a local.
So the Keen Act that happened in the actual Watchmen from 1977, that banned vigilante, his son, Joe Keen Jr., mm-hmm. said, I am going to allow the cops, I guess only in Oklahoma or around the country, maybe.
Tulsa. It's only in Tulsa.
But the program is spreading.
Yeah, yes.
So other people are taking.
Because of the events of the White Knight, the cops want to protect themselves. So the cops are now able to wear masks and stuff to protect their identity
and hide their identity
to enforce law in Tulsa. So that's the only time that they're like they made an amendment to this Keen Act by Joseph Keen Jr.
And then the other major plot point is that Robert Redford is our president.
Yes, the actor.
The actor Robert Redford, right? Because what's his name? Ronald Reagan. Thank you.
Yes.
What's his name? But one of his first major acts in the country is what's known as the Redfordations.
Yes.
Okay. And basically what it is like anyone who suffered from the injustices that happened in the Tulsa riots now will get bequeathed a sum of money from the government
mm-hmm.
as almost like an apology.
Mm-hmm.
This shifts the balance of power in Tulsa, where now black people are the people in power, right? And when I say in power, I mean like they have the wealth, they have the jobs, they have the nice homes, pushing white people out to what's known as the Nixonvilles, which is just like the slums,
mm-hmm.
right? This is the trailer park. This is all very important for the rest of the show because it is, the question is like, what happens if the tables do flip? This is ultimately, I think, what the question of the show is. Like, what happens if black people and minorities end up amassing power that was once the white person's? What do these white people feel? Which I think it's safe to say, like, the white man, based on who was in president, has been feeling this way for a while, despite the fact that we have nothing, but whatever.
Yeah. It's also completely evident that even though Rorschach left this journal with a newspaper guy, the events, the true events that happened because of Adrian Veidt have not been released to the public.
Yes, the other major plot point, you're right.
Yes. So that's important because it's left in the open at the end of Watchmen. So we're still ignorant in 2019.
Right, except for a very small group of people who believe that what Rorschach wrote in his journals that were published is truth. And these people are actually extremists, racist extremists. They're known as the Seventh Cavalry. Although, spoiler alert, they are more insidious than that.
Yes.
So,
there's a lot there's to a talk lot. About.
We just spit out a lot of plot points here, which sounds really complicated, right? Like, this is a show that definitely needs you to sit down and really watch it. And, like, you need to have not necessarily the strongest understanding of the Watchmen property, but, like, a passing understanding. Because names get dropped that are important to the past.
Yes, and events, too. You know, we and find events. Out one of the cops, Looking Glass, was traumatized by the events of 1985, and that's important for his character growth. You need to know what happened in 1985.
So, in 1985. So, in the movie, it was Dr. Manhattan that destroys New York. In this version, which is more based off of comics, it is a giant squid. They go with the giant squid monster and stuff. Yes. And this is it. But initial reactions from everybody go from based off of what you guys saw.
I wasn't anticipating to enjoy this as much as I did. This was a really strong first season of a TV show. It went in different directions and spoke on levels that I just was not anticipating.
Yeah.
So this is one of the biggest surprises that I've had in a while.
For sure.
And I really enjoyed it.
It's a good way to end the year, I would agree.
Yes.
Again, I think that it's a good depiction of superhero vigilante type of story. It gives great backstory. I love the backstories and how everything connects. Again, I'm speaking from a writer's perspective. I thought that to show present and then eventually show gradually how past events have led up to this very moment was really played out well. Yeah, so I thought it was good. I thought it was good.
Yeah.
Eddie Z.
I remember seeing the previews to this and not being attracted. I thought thinking like, oh, is this going to be like a gritty cop show? Is this going to be like a mystery solving crime within the Watchmen universe? But seeing the first season of this, I was just amazed about what it is about power, about people who have power, people who want power. And the balance of that power, about race, about money, and just like integrating to the Watchmen, just the Watchmen characters from the past in this to kind of highlight those things. Like we see these characters 34 years later after the event of the comic books, and seeing what has happened to them too, which I always love too.
So yeah, so same. I think we can all agree. This is a great show. This is an excellent first season. It's a show that for sure, even though it's based off of a comic book series, it feels like so different from anything I've seen on TV, and that's what kind of makes it so fresh. I think its connection to the source material is also what kind of keeps it level. Like this is clearly the writers of this show have an utmost respect to the original comic book.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Zack Snyder didn't have the respect. I just think he was just too literal with his translation. And here is taking like, all right, we're taking this comic book world that he created. We're going to tell something new, but we're still going to be confined to the lore that is the Watchmen. I will agree. The trailer for this show didn't do a good job selling it because they were hiding everything they could. Because there are so many satisfying reveals. And I'm going to give you guys all, if you guys haven't finished it, it finished, I think, two weeks ago by the time this airs.
Yeah.
We're going to spoil it. There's going to be a lot of spoilers. But you can't talk about the show without talking about these spoilers. And I think my favorite spoiler for me is just like the Laurie Blake.
She's my favorite character. She's so great.
Jean Smart
is fucking great.
Performance that she gives is like, I love Regina King. Don't get me wrong, I love Regina King. She's great in this show, but Jean Smart steals every scene that she's in. She's just like captivating.
She's
even
really
when she's
great.
Kidnapped, right? Just she's still so snarky.
Yeah,
like she's like tied up and stuff, and she, you know, the guy comes to save her. It's Looking Glass, right? She's just like Mirror Man.
Yeah, Mirror Guy.
Like, you're just like, you're in danger and you still have it in you to like kind of be a bitch, and I'm here for it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Yeah. Funny how she turned into her father.
Yes. Oh my God. Smart. I didn't even realize that. You're right. Mm-hmm. So Laurie Blake. So if you remember watching The Watchmen or if you read the comic books, Laurie Blake is the Silk Spectre. And this performance that Jean Smart gives is easily one of the best ones. Look,
yes.
I love Regina King. I think she was spectacular in the show. But Jean Grey, any scene she was in, she just stole.
Jean Smart.
I said Jean Grey.
Jean Grey's from the X-Men.
Jean Smart. It's such a wonderfully told character because it really changes the character, where I think Silk Spectre was very passive in the first movie.
She was, yes. And she was also someone who, she was reluctantly a superhero. She was pushed into it by her mother to join essentially the family business. Mm-hmm. And she was just kind of like sick and tired of it all.
And now she took that sick and tired of it all to like decide to like kind of put an end to vigilantism. I love this kind of this role that she has, right? So she is part of the anti-vigilante task force. Her job is to bring in masked vigilantes.
Yes.
Which is ironic, obviously, because we know who she is.
We should also say that in the original Watchmen, she was under the belief that her father was Captain Metropolis. But it turns out, or Hood of Justice, one of those?
No, I think it was Captain Metropolis.
Well, we find out that those two superheroes are actually gay men who were secretly gay because they couldn't be because it was the 40s and the 50s, and that her real father was actually Edward Blake, the comedian, who she also knew attempted and or maybe did he actually attempted. Do it attempted to rape her mother,
but they
and
turned
then,
out to
and then but revealed. She turned out to pursue him and they were romantically involved, which is troublesome.
There wasn't any. Who? No.
The original Silk Spectre. You're talking about
the Silk. I was just like, that was his daughter.
No. Not the original Silk Spectre.
Yes, and they were in love.
Yes. And so, and then that like kind of like fucks her up. So by the time it's 2019, Laurie, she has adopted the name of Laurie Blake, because in the original book, her name was Laurie Jepeski or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I can't. It's a lot of.
But now she's Laurie Blake, and she's essentially turned into her father.
Which you pointed that out, and I didn't even realize that. Like, that's a good observation. Like, her snarkiness, like who
cynical,
she is. Yeah.
She's a smart ass. You know, she's essentially a comedian.
The best, easily the best character, despite the fact.
But really great.
Any other characters that stand out for you guys performance wise? No?
Well, Regina King.
Regina King. Regina, I mean, King. Angela Abar.
Wait, can we just go back to also Laurie Blake's vibrator?
Yes.
Dr. Manhattan vibrator.
It's a giant blue vibrator.
Big fan of that. I was like, they really fucking did that right now. Big fan of that. Okay,
yes, Regina King. Let's talk a little about Regina King and her performance. As do you guys know a lot of Regina King stuff? Or I only know her really from one show that I used to love.
Which is?
Southland.
Okay.
So she was.
But
she's also the voice on Boondocks.
She is also the voice on Boondocks.
And she had a show on Netflix.
Which show?
7 Seconds.
Yeah, something like
that. Seven Seconds. Yeah,
I haven't seen 7 Seconds. I loved her performance in Southland. She played a cop, and she just brings like this humanity to a cop show that I had never seen, and I just love her performance in it.
Yeah.
And I think she brings that similar humanity to this badass character,
Definitely. Sister Knight. I mean, this woman's been in everything as a character actress, from Jerry Maguire and Friday. She Miss Congeniality.
She was also a child actor.
She was also a child actress. So this is like her first.
Oh,
see,
that was a running series. It was really good.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know my Regina King history, but
she was also in. I want to say, was it Poetic Justice?
No, she wasn't Poetic Justice. You're right. Yeah. She was. And she recently a big role that she had was If Beale Street Could Talk. Which was the Moonlight director's follow-up to Moonlight.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like this is really like the Regina King show, finally.
This is Regina King, hopefully, will start getting like the attention she most definitely deserves. Because
she was great in this.
Again, she's hiding so many things in this series.
And The Big Bang Theory. She was in The Big Bang Theory.
God, she's been in a lot.
Yeah, she's a lot.
But yeah, so Regina King is like, her character is hiding so much. You just do not know. You just don't know like what you can take literally from her or whatnot, because she has so many secrets.
Yeah,
I think she gives like such a great performance. I think her mom, her moments like when she's the moment she has with her kids is some of the most sentimental stuff, obviously. And it doesn't feel like cheesy. Mm-hmm. It really feels real. Like, she is a broken woman.
Yeah.
And she's, well, she's an orphan. Best. Yes.
So because they're able to dress up as cops, they actually have nicknames. Mm-hmm. And hers is Sister Night, which we later find out, because she was raised in Vietnam, was from a blaxploitation film that she always wanted to see that she couldn't. So it was also like this precious moment in her childhood that uh-huh. she's kind of keeping dear to her. So she becomes Sister Night. And she has a significant other called Calvin, and they have adopted 3 children.
Yes. They lost their parents during the White Night.
Yes. So they're like her. They were orphaned like her.
The parents were cops,
yeah,
too.
Yes. They were cops.
They were Regina King's partner.
Yeah.
And so that's why she adopted them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think we should just point out the obvious. They were white. Yes. The kids they were white. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you kind of see what an African-American couple, a black couple raising white children. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I was like, oh, this is interesting. Uh-huh. It's like, what's the, you know?
Because it's not revealed until like episode 2, if I remember correctly. It was not revealed in the very first episode, right? Yeah. You just see a black couple with 3 white kids. Mm-hmm. It's not. So this is another point of the show where they really take their time. They're very slow in kind of giving you the reveals. And when they do give you reveals, like, they have excellent payoffs.
Yeah.
Calvin would be one of those big reveals that doesn't happen until the later half of the series. And that's mm-hmm. fucking
well, I'm going to tell you, when I first saw it, I was like, why do they have white kids?
Yeah.
Like, why don't they have white kids? Like, yeah. I was kind of pissed about that. I was like, are we trying to whitewash this again? But I say, okay, we got to have a black lead, but it got to be surrounded by all white cast. Uh-huh. You know, and so.
Interesting. Go on.
But it also, it's like, the controversy that surrounded this was people were saying that it's racially charged, right? Where whites were not happy with this new version of Watchmen. And I just thought that it was kind of foolish because there's only like 4 black people in the whole show. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, everyone else is white.
Very good point.
And although Regina King, even though those 4 black people are more prominent members of the cast, they're still surrounded by all white in a town that's supposed to be predominantly black.
That's a very excellent observation. It's true.
Because uh-huh. I didn't even realize that the town's supposed to be predominantly black until you said that. And I was like, really? And I said, it's so interesting because I didn't really see any black people in the show.
It's true. You
do that. So I was confused as to the argument, like people were saying online, like, oh, this isn't real Watchmen. Then the counter argument, like, you know, they're just being racist. I'm like, well, where's the racism?
Well, yeah. I will say I understand, like, as a white person, like, the white people are basically the bad guys from the beginning of the show to the very end. And they're racists. They are racist. They are part of a racist cult. They have these firm beliefs of white nationalism. They are racist. But I don't think they're not saying all white people. They're saying just racist white people are bad guys. And I don't think that's a very bold statement. I think most Americans would agree with that. So,
but then again, you have the Red Scare. You have the Russian partner. You have, what's the guy? Looking Glass. You know, these were, you know, positive white faces that were there. I mean, yes, you had the Cyclops group, right?
Yes, Cyclops.
Which was actually, you know, that's a version of a Ku Klux Klan, you know? So, I mean, that's obvious, right? And we are talking about Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So, to me, that doesn't necessarily paint all white people as bad or say that, oh, this is white versus black and this is good versus bad. Because by default, this is Klan country and Klan people are white. So, I mean, it was just obvious for me.
Part of the problem is that we do live in an outrage culture, and people are looking for any excuse to be outraged. Oh, and that goes on both sides of the spectrum here, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, being portrayed as like in the negative light, it pisses off apparently some white audiences. But they're, keep in mind, their outrage is stemming from a political agenda, mm-hmm. a ideological agenda. So you can't take their outrage for it's not necessarily real criticism.
Yeah.
It's just outrage for the sake of being outraged, because I think this show does a very good job of kind of putting race front and center, which is something I was not expecting for a comic book show, to be totally honest.
Yeah.
I mean, we might as well talk about it, but episode 4 or 6, which is the episode that has a flashback that
the nostalgia?
nostalgia. That was six episode. Or seven. That was six. Yeah. Okay, so episode six, which is one of the first times that I think we see race, even more so than even like Black Panther, right? Like play real front and center for a comic book property.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this one? Because I think me and Nicole have seen, at this point, we've been doing the podcast for a year and a half, stuff like this can feel very exploitative. And I did not ever get that feeling here. I think they told a very, very well-told story that doesn't feel like they're just exploiting race for like making controversy.
By six, I thought six was really, really great when they went and showed us, what's his name? Hood of Justice and like how he started. Right, and how he started. I think, and that was to me even a little bit more palatable because that those dynamics we've seen in other movies. Mm-hmm. We've seen how Black people were treated back then. So that, to me, I felt like a wider audience was able to digest that a little bit more. And I think that it was cool to see that the Hooded Justice was really Black, even though he's painted himself as white, because no one wanted to see a Black superhero. They wanted to know that he was white.
That was a very like surprising reveal. I wasn't expecting it. It was just like satisfying to kind of, I think, you know, they did a great job of kind of like when you see the line that he paints and then you see the mirror reflection and it's her, right? This is a great episode that has a lot of great camera work going on for it.
What I didn't like though, again, and keep in mind, me personally versus me understanding. I totally understand why he did it this way. Personally, and I probably would have done the same way too, even though I personally object to it. Why do they have to have him be in love with a white man in the show? That is what I was like, you're going home every day to this Black woman and you have a black child. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, you're having an affair with a white man. I'm not against having an affair with a man per se. Yeah. But why do they have to be a white man? And then like, I just felt that it was kind of...
So they might be...
We can't have nothing.
They might be stuck in terms here with canon based off of the original property.
For sure.
Yes, yes.
So this is, again, this is the writers. They are taking this universe. There's already an existing history, so they're stuck with it. Yes. So this is how they're kind of explaining it. So I'll give that.
And I totally understood. That's why I said I would have done the same thing.
True, yeah.
But as for example, I wasn't... If I was just a regular viewer, did not know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
My first reaction is... Here we go again, right?
Well, it's nice because in a way it does an homage to Alan Moore's book because he's a flawed character. You know, he makes poor decisions. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hood of Justice, this identity kind of ruins him in a weird way. And also, I, as a gay person too, I'm like, oh, someone who has an identity that they're not expressing. So it's kind of like slightly tapping into that. You know, personally, as a gay viewer, I wanted it to be expanded upon even more because I didn't even think he was in love with him. I just thought he wanted to fuck on the side. You know, so.
And there is a payoff to that relationship because at the end of that episode, we see the Hooded Justice, you know, kind of try to start putting an end to these plans that they have. Mm-hmm. And he calls Captain Metropolis. Right. And Captain Metropolis just blows them off.
Right, yeah.
Right. And right there, that's like, I think that is a very satisfying payoff to that kind of romance. As short as it was, it's satisfying because, again, it kind of, it's fucked up as it is. It does paint, again, it's just like you can only trust yourself and the people like you. It's a fucked up theme to this episode, but that's really what they're going with. And that's the same argument that his wife was making. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact he thought that he could be above this, and he turns out he's wrong.
Yeah.
He's alone in this, like, because racism is so prevalent in America.
Which goes back to the original book too, because that's exactly what happened to the comedian in a very different way. You know, like the Hood of Justice was brought to this place by racism, but like the comedian was just brought to it by like life. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, you know, like you can't save the day. And all of this is at the end going to kill you and like probably make you a very unhappy, ruined person. Mm-hmm. And there is no way you can save the world. So it actually also... echoes the theme of the original book, which is nice because I, at first when I was watching it, although I was enjoying it, I thought they were going a little carried away with like a 2019 kind of perspective, you know, like that was mirroring our own identity with the Seventh Cavalry,
right?
And race wars. But when it started getting into that, I really was like, oh my gosh, this is actually doing a better job than I was anticipating of keeping the theme of the original 1985 Watchmen.
And I think part of, not just theme-wise, I think one of the best choices they do is kind of introducing these characters from the actual original property later on. Or at least revealing who they are later on. Like, Laurie Blake doesn't come in until like episode 3. We don't reveal that Ozymandias is Ozymandias until episode two, despite the fact that like we kind of figured it out. But like even then, that's not revealed until a whole episode later, right? They start off strong by kind of telling you is like this is going to take place in this world, but like first we're going to establish the rules right now of the time that we're in before we start bringing all the baggage that comes in from the past, and that baggage is heavy. But again, we have given you guys spoiler warnings, but like. Let's talk a little bit about one of the big reveals towards the end of the show.
Lady True is...
Oh, well, Lady True is another...
Agent. She's my second favorite
character. Before we go into that, like, I just want to talk about the female characters in this show, how fucking badass they all are.
Yeah.
Regina King, Lori Blake, but True. By the end of this show, just like, she went somewhere I was not expecting her to go.
Yeah.
And I'm here for it. I was just like, oh, I was enamored with her, despite the fact that... She was the bad guy.
Yeah. Well, what I really appreciated the show is like...
Yeah, that's the thing, was, too.
That's it's good was versus bad.
Well, if you're listening to Adrian Voight's description of her, I'm leaning towards like, yeah, I can't...
Yeah, but you're talking about Adrian Voight.
Well, it takes one to know one.
Who sees himself as the savior of humanity.
Who drops a squid and kills 3 million people to save what?
He understands his genes in him, right? But I think he also understands like his own restraints that he does put upon himself.
What restraints are these?
What restraints did he put on himself?
He destroyed only one city, right? And then he only destroys like little baby squids to like keep terrifying the world into peace.
But you see when he's even his continuous disrespect for life. Mm-hmm. Yes. Especially when he's in this paradise and he's able to create these servants for himself,
and
he
kills at whim.
He massacres a whole group of them to send a message out.
And
even that scene when he creates these brand new ones and he walks into the dining room and there's just bodies everywhere in the dining room, and it's like this man has no respect for life,
and yet he was humanity's savior.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on how you frame that. Could he have done something different? Did he have to kill 3 million people? I mean, there's a story that says you crack a few eggs and make an omelet. Okay, fine, true. Sometimes we have to go to war to stop a terrible bigger event from happening. I get that, but sometimes I think it begs the question: could there have been another way? And just because he's the world's smartest man doesn't necessarily mean he is omnipotent and omniscient, right? So just because that's the only thing that he thought of, that's his ego. Like, ego played a huge part in both for him and for True. And that's the problem with the, what's that name? True, right?
True.
Yeah, True.
Was their ego. They thought that they knew better.
Yeah. I still like
and
True.
So although their motive and their intentions were good, it still begs the question, was their ego blinding them to other options that could have been available, that could have been less traumatic, or, that could have saved more lives?
Yeah, well, that's what's great about the text in general, too, is the lines that get blurred, I think, between good or bad, or like, who's really, like, is there anyone who's clearly a good or a bad guy in this, and like... Everyone is just so complicated, and things are so complicated that your relationship and your engagement with it begs so many questions that you have to ask yourself. What I liked a lot about this show was how many things we saw 34 years later in this element. Lady Chu in particular, she invented a drug called nostalgia that you can take and you can trip and have other people's experiences to the point where you think that the downside is that if you, what is it, overdose on it, you become that person.
Right.
Well, she initially did it to fix
dementia
and Alzheimer's, which I thought was cool because you save your memories, and if you start forgetting, you eat one and then you get
your memory back. Yeah. But then she does it to clone her mother.
Yes.
To create babies and then pretty much bribe people off their land and say, here's a baby or else I'm going to kill it in a minute. Man. That was our introduction.
No, that was a joke, but...
That was another great True moment right there where she's willing to gamble with this clone's life. It's this show is
bonkers. And the relationship with life, just like her, as we find out her father.
Uh-huh. Well,
and how we can make or create life, or how people who think that they are gods believe so.
Speaking of her father, played by Jeremy Irons in a wonderfully spectacular over-the-top performance, yet it still feels so grounded.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, it's just like he is giving a larger-than-life performance as Adrian Veidt, but keep in mind the circumstances around this performance. He's stuck in nowhere.
Yeah.
He's surrounded by these servant clones, right? He can act how he is clearly left to his own whims, and this is how he chooses to act out. And that performance just makes him so grandiose. Like, this is a good performance for Jeremy Irons that I was, again, not expecting.
Yeah, he comes off as what I would envision Andrea Invite to be, you know, and like definitely thinks he's some sort of Alexander the Great asshole. Mm-hmm. So, some other characters, just really quick to throw out, Don Johnson, who was in the first episode, played Judd Crawford. Yes. His murder kind of sets everything off.
As the comedian's murder sets off the conspiracy, right? Like, yes. this is basically, if you think about it too, this is also basically almost following the novel to a, not to a T, but like it's kind of following the structure. Mm-hmm. We start off with a murder that kind of leads to an investigation that kind of leads to a conspiracy.
Just like it, yeah.
That is ultimately about trying to save humanity.
Yeah. And I just want to add into that, again, the dynamic of, was he really a bad guy? Was he a good guy? Oh. Because from what we later find out is that he was leading a part of the
Seven Cavalry. What was it called? Cyclops. Yeah.
Cyclops.
He was one of those, yeah, he was a Cyclops. And so, but according to the senator, because the senator was leading a group and he was also leading a group.
Oh, that hot senator.
But they were both saying that the groups were formed anyway. These people were on a rampage anyway. What we tried to do was redirect some of that so that they don't do what they could have done.
Yeah.
And so the question here is, was Chief Judd correct in assuming that position? Could and again, these, you know, I deal with people all the time, and I see people in these in very similar, not as, you know, not as big, grandiose positions, but I see them in these positions where they make a choice in the moment that they thought at that time was a good choice, mm-hmm. based on the limited amount of information they had. And if you really think about it, he was leading a police force, they all got slaughtered, and then all of a sudden he had an opportunity to make sure that this group of people don't do more damage by assuming a leadership role in that group. Then the question becomes, is he bad for at least for allowing them to do some bad? Because it goes back to Adrian Veidt's position of, I killed 3 million to save 6 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
and they orchestrated the White Knight.
They're the ones who basically took the Cyclops group, evolved them into the White Knight, and then led them in different directions.
Which mirrors, again, actions that happened in the original watch.
And so the question, because, you know, I felt bad for Chief Judd, actually. Oh. You know, I thought that
no,
he...
No, his wife.
Well, his wife was like, really?
We don't want to hear your silly little speech.
What was it with the trap? Yeah,
that was great. That was
which
great.
I felt like Agent Blake should have just moved when she.
Yeah, I could.
She saw the chair move once. Why didn't she get up?
Yeah, well, I mean, she wanted to see what was going to happen. I'm sure, but still,
Agent Blake was all about the drama.
Yeah,
but I thought Chief Judd actually intrinsically thought that he was doing the right thing. And so it always...
From his identity point of view, yeah.
From his perspective, he really thought he was doing the right thing. And even when I work with individuals personally, I have to separate action from intent. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people have truly great intentions. You know the saying, the road to hell is paved with great intentions. I think that people truly have these great intentions and they just make wrong choices. And that's not the same thing as Senator Kaine, who was literally looking for power. Chief Judd wasn't doing that.
Right.
You know, he actually did care about the community. He cared about his cops. He cared about other things. And he felt that this was the best way to maintain some level of order.
It all gets blown up when they reveal that they've been planning this for a while, when they discovered that Dr. Manhattan might be in Tulsa. But we can talk about, I think, the Watchmen TV show for a while,
for a
only
time.
Because it's so good, but we're going super long. So does anyone have any?
We should talk about Cal.
Cal. All right. Who wants to actually lay the facts?
Let's do the guess.
Who is Cal?
Cal is the real identity of Cal?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Cal is Dr. Manhattan.
Cal is Dr. Manhattan, which was revealed in one of the final
episodes. Seven or eight,
yes.
Yeah, 8 was the whole time episode, which was, other than the Hood of Justice episode, the two best episodes of the season.
But yeah, so we learned that that Dr. Manhattan had returned to Earth after he got bored in the moon of Jupiter.
Yeah, he didn't go to Mars.
He didn't go to Mars.
Even though there's boots where you can call Dr. Manhattan to Mars, which is really, we later find out, set up by Lady Chu to try and find this guy because she wants his powers. Right. That's his whole fucking thing.
There's a conspiracy afoot.
Yeah.
It has been going for a while. But yeah, so Dr. Manhattan had come to Earth Why he picked Angela, we do not know.
There's got to be a reason for
there that. There is. That hopefully will get resolved later. But he falls in love with Angela. And part of the what we see this relationship develop is that he, as he sees time, like in this episode, they do a really excellent job of like kind of showing you how Dr. Manhattan perceives time, which mm-hmm. is something that was lacking in the 2009 Watchmen movie. Mm-hmm. So I think this portrayal of Dr. Manhattan is actually very wonderful in that sense. What we learned is that he loves Angela so much that he's kind of willing to kind of put his powers aside for her in order to pursue a relationship, despite the fact that he knows how the relationship is going to end because he warned her from the get-go. It will end in 10 years. It will end
tragically. She asked
how? Yeah, tragically.
But see, mm-hmm. but that kind of answers your question of why he picked Angela. It's almost like he knows what's going to happen, but he does nothing to stop any
it's
of it.
It's very self-fulfilling so prophecy.
It's almost like, you know, I have to go see Angela because that's what my future's already told me is she's the one.
I looked in time and I found out I loved you. Yeah.
Right, but by doing that, it's also causing the actual future he saw.
Yeah. But there's something about that. It's just like, but why? Why?
But why did he go out and stop her from when they were shooting up? And he could have stopped everybody. But why didn't he? Well, why didn't he when he was out in the field and he killed all the guys to protect her? Why didn't he stop the guy from actually going to activate the device that would trap him? He could have done a lot of things to stop him.
So many different things. So he does say though, when she brings him fully into consciousness, that he's confused. Mm-hmm. That is like his mind is catching up with time.
Yeah, so but that was very temporary.
Temporary, but it's all happening when the shootout's going to take place, when they're going to be attacked.
Yeah, that was all within minutes of each other.
Yeah. So he's still trying to, I feel like there's still things that he's not totally aware of as he's defending her. But wait a minute,
when she says, we did it, he says no.
That's true.
He knew it was going to happen.
Well, because he knows
he's experiencing time. He already knows what's happening.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, he already knew what was going to happen.
Well, maybe he didn't, but that's the thing. He only knows, so he didn't see what happened, right? He didn't see that he was going to get transported. He just saw, like, he wasn't looking
at her. He knew about the transportation.
No, I know he knew about the transport, but he was looking at Angela, right? So he didn't know that, but he probably didn't know there was another person behind him.
He told her, he said, no, it's not over.
Because he knows what's going to happen next.
That doesn't make any sense.
He doesn't see a happy ending.
It doesn't make any sense.
The Dr. Manhattan character is flawed both in comics and in the TV show in this sense.
Yes. Because of human beings writing it.
Despite the fact that they did a really excellent job of like humanizing him in this episode.
Almost to a fault.
Oh, I don't know if it's to a fault. I think Dr. Manhattan needs a little humanity in him.
As you guys can tell from this conversation, this is a heavy-handed show. There's a lot to it. There's just, they spent a lot of time and they did the story really, really well. And all it does is raises new questions and new theories. As a good show should. So we encourage you to watch it. We definitely can go on and on for hours, but if you haven't seen it, you gotta watch it.
We just touched the surface of all the things that really, all the themes that really were done in the show.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you have seen it, please share your thoughts with us, because this is also something that, you know, we've only tapped into a small part of it. Mm-hmm. For the sake of time, we are probably going to put a pause on the topic of Watchmen for now.
For now. Do you want to do a lightning round? Because we could do it with the original, a few characters that we have from the original.
Lightning round.
How about we compare Adrian Veidt's?
Jeremy Irons' Adrian Veidt is so much better than, that was a Skarsgård, right?
No, the original, so the 2009 Ozymandias was played by, he's not even, Matthew Good.
Ew, okay.
Well, when I read the Alan Moore comic, I feel like Jeremy Irons is more, he really gets what I thought Adrian Veidt was to be, which is a pompous man, but, you know.
Arrogant. Do you have a preference, Lincoln?
For which one?
Ozymandias.
Which portrayal of Ozymandias?
I think Jeremy Irons was a really good one.
Yeah.
Silk Spectre, Laurie Blake. Go ahead.
The original was Malin Ackerman.
Yes, good job.
I thought she was good.
She was good. I also think that the 1985 portrayal of the Laurie character, which we didn't really get into, is, in my opinion, troublesome. I think that she's defined by her sexual relationships, and no other character is, as in the two Silk Spectres are. And that's always frustrating as a woman to be like, why is she defined by her sex and all of this stuff? But whatever. I like how complicated she becomes in this new Watchmen. So they really gave her more. And I just appreciate that all around. I appreciated most of the women in the 2019 version of Watchmen.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. I think that the original one's more of a damsel than a real, like, because she was following Owlman around. You know,
she
was following.
She was following Manhattan.
And then not Owlman. Really. She wasn't her own self. Now, keep in mind, of course, her she's comes from a crazy background, so she's trying to figure her own life out. So I get that, but I think that Jean Smart really kind of did a really great job.
Yeah, at portraying her. And I like that they just put Night Owl in jail or something so she could be alone. Yeah. I liked that because we never saw Lori alone. But it also
gives her motivation for her actions.
It does too, and which is sweet.
Again,
but
smart.
Really, we get to just see her, not tied down by her relationship.
I'm also gonna go with Jean.
Yeah,
with Jean Smart.
Great actress.
I was gonna say Gray.
Jean Smart.
Now, a fair comparison would be the Dr. Manhattans.
I think that,
that is a fair one. I think I actually like the original Dr. Manhattan better.
Because you like Billy Crudup.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did. I don't, and yeah, I just thought that the new one was cool. It was nothing wrong with him, but I guess because he was too human.
Okay. I agree.
Fair.
You know, it was like, you got all this power and you're, I don't know.
He wasn't as cold and as detached as you would expect that character to be, especially from the previous events that he went through.
This is all you.
I think the portrayal of Dr. Manhattan and experiencing time, like we said in that episode, is far superior.
Uh-huh.
But I think the actual portrayal of who Dr. Manhattan is, it just doesn't feel like this character. It doesn't feel like the character from the comic book either.
Exactly.
I agree with both of you.
Yeah.
I actually am going to probably say Billy Crudup might be my favorite Dr. Manhattan, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I did like Calvin as a character.
Mm-hmm. I like Calvin as Calvin.
As Calvin. Yeah, Calvin. I think he was such a nice foil for Regina King's like Angela Abar. Yeah. But I'm going to say this. I know that we got some dong in the original Watchmen. And here they went full dong. And my God.
The original Watchmen, we got full too.
No, we did. Yeah, I'm just saying. But comparison wise, like, this is
got
like,
more dong time.
This was
we literal, actually got more dong time in the original.
I'm talking about
Watchmen.
Literal dong.
There's no, we did
much more penis
in the original.
No.
In the movie,
I'm talking about the size of his penis, guys. Like it was obscene. Like how.
I don't know. I mean, they were both big.
The other one was like modest, I think. I think Billy Crudup was a modest penis. I think it was also CGI. This one was a guy painted blue, so this is like all him.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was prosthetics.
No.
No.
No? Okay.
That was gracious. Amazing. Yeah, that was crazy.
So, that should be the comparison we should have done.
Yeah.
Which penis?
But as far as the acting, I do think that the original Dr. Manhattan was a better portrayal of it. Because even when Calvin changed back into Dr. Manhattan, he was still giving me Calvin.
Yes.
He did not give me Dr. Manhattan. Even if he felt love for her, he still did not give that omnipotent type of air.
Yeah,
we don't know necessarily this is still side effects from like the thing that he had done, because even she reacted the same way. They don't ever show his face until after he turns into Calvin.
But he's sitting in the cage. He's sitting here like, you know, just meek. And defeated. Like, that's not...
I guess it's probably... I don't know.
No, not the same person who walked through Vietnam and killed everybody.
Keep in mind, a lot of our saviors, when they know they're going to die, like, this is how they are. Jesus was the same way right before he was crucified. Like, he knew this is the moment. It's coming.
Yeah, but he never was arrogant.
No, I agree with you.
He was the same person.
Yeah.
Up until the very end. Nicole? I just think that... go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, with how the series ends, also, we are led to believe... I'm going to have to spoil this for you, Rolando.
No.
And we wonder if this is truly Dr. Manhattan in full, but a portion of who he is. So.
Okay, good. Did you finish?
Yeah, I didn't really give off too much. But,
I didn't hear anything. But.
So on that note, wow, what an episode. We hope you liked it.
What a year,
2019. Be sure to tune in a couple of days because we're going to do a full recap episode of this year in remakes, reboots, and revivals. Lincoln, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. This was awesome.
It's good to have you.
Really good to have you.
You were a good voice to have for this episode.
Yeah. I'm surprised.
Well, whenever you want me back, I am available.
Heard that.
Awesome. Well, We really want to hear from you guys. You can reach out to us on social media. You can hit us up on our Instagram at Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
Yes. You can also email us because I love reading emails. And I guess sometimes if they're short, enough. We'll read them on air. You can email us. Our email is remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com.
Yes.
And Lincoln, what's your social media for either yourself, or do you want to post for your, for, yeah, check out your work?
Sure.
Where can people check out your work?
You go online, www.farcornerstudios.com, and that's FARCORNERSSTUDIOS.com. Great. And we're on Twitter, Far Corners S. And my Twitter is FCS Chief. And just come on, check us out. Email me, teamgenesis@farcornerstudios.com.
Yes.
And we'll put all the information in the, like, the show.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but, and I will make sure you guys get our Wonder Woman script.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Yeah, put
yes.
that in the show notes, too.
Hopefully definitely. Fans check that out.
Yes.
Definitely send it to me ASAP.
I could do it right now.
Okay, cool. All right. Sweet. Well, Happy New Year's.
Happy New Year's. Yes.
Happy New Year's.
New Year's Eve, I think we're doing this, right?
Yeah,
this...
and we will... The day before.
Day before New Year's Eve.
But, and we will catch you guys in the next decade. In the next... A new decade of remakes, reboots, and revivals.
Yes.
So until then,
stay unoriginal.